Do you know, we really should be doing more podcasts, and I'll try my best to bring those along. This is a football fans podcast and the people behind CelticUnderground.net. Look, I know we've not been doing the podcast as often as I keep saying that we will do, and we will bring them along shortly, but while you're waiting on those, we at least have another podcast coming up, and this one is St Anthony, once again with a special guest discussing all things Celtic and all things Gorbals. So that is enough from me. I'll hand you now over to St Anthony talking with Gordon Cowan all about Celtic fans and their history in the Gorbals.
It's my pleasure to be joined tonight by Gordon Cowan on the latest Celtic Underground podcast. We've decided to have this podcast in view of the fact that the last one in the governing history of Celtic fans went down so well. It was decided that we should look at other areas, and the one we're looking at tonight is the Gorbals, a famous area of Glasgow rich in Celtic heritage. So the first thing to say is welcome, Gordon.
Thank you.
And as always on the podcast, the first question we always ask somebody new who comes on is, what was your first Celtic game and who was your first Celtic hero?
The first Celtic game I have got any memory of, I'll always take as a babe in arms, was actually New Year's Day 1959 at Ibrox.
This isn't going to end well, is it?
No, it's not. We lost 2-1. It was a horrible day. It had sleet, rain, snow, howling wind. And the reason that game sticks in my mind is simply because you're at the game. It was actually my mum was propping me up in the cold, freezing barrier. And I remember the man in front of me, in those days lots of people wore hats, this man had what you would call a Homburg hat on, and the rim of his hat was always filling up with water, and he kept taking it off and shaking off the water. I always thought that'd be a good start of a book, actually. That's the first time you get a view of the hoops. But that's the first game I remember. Horrific, terrible conditions, and we get beat 2-1. We got a penalty at Ibrox, amazingly enough, but it was missed by Mr. Auld.
Barely missed a penalty.
Apparently, I think it was 5 minutes to go. But it was really the conditions as much as anything else that really stuck my mind.
So I know Charlie Gallagher missed a penalty at Ibrox.
Charlie missed one on the 5th of September 1964, I think, John Thompson's the moment. We beat them straight, because that was the first time I'd seen Celtic beat Rangers.
Who was the one in the early 60s that was a chance?
Paddy Crane missed a penalty at Celtic Park as well. That's when Baxter was putting them off. Beat us 1-0. We get beat all the time. That's what happened. But no, the day Charlie missed it, it actually hit the post, and I think it may have been for a shy. But we beat them 3-1. That was the first time I'd seen Celtic beat Rangers.
So first hero then?
This could be controversial. It was Frank Caffey. I wanted to be a goalkeeper when I was a wee boy, and lots of old photographs of me diving about the back court in the Gorbals with goalkeeper's gloves on, and I just took to Frank. It was quite controversial, obviously, because Frank could be fantastic one game and terrible the next. The examples of that are probably the 1963 Scottish Cup final, when he was great on the Saturday, but kind of was it too good in the Wednesday night when we get beat 3-0, and of course the 9-3 game at Wembley when unfortunately he was in goal.
That's the thing he's always going to be remembered for, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I was looking at the statistics of that game recently, and it was only really in the last 15 minutes that were the goals. Well, England scored a lot of the goals. But the other thing he was famous for as well, of course, was taking a penalty at Celtic Park. And
he missed that as well.
Well, I either missed it, or you could, if you're an Airdrie supporter, you would say that Roddy McKenzie saved it. But it was 9-0 at the time, forgive him. But he actually was on one of the Radio Scotland programmes a number of years ago. He was visiting, and you could send in your text messages. And I sent in a text message just saying, I'm still your fan, Frank. And I recall a game that I don't actually know who we were playing, but he took a goal kick at Celtic Park, and the ball blew in. He never actually left the penalty. The ball blew into the back of the net.
Mm-hmm.
His own net, but obviously it wasn't a goal. But that's kind of the things that happened to Frank. Mm-hmm. And he was a great singer, of course.
He was. He was. He seemed, I mean, like, obviously it's just a bit before my time, but yeah, he seemed to leave quite suddenly. I mean, he was goalkeeper up until probably 63,
yeah, mid-63. He left in 64, I think. Yeah, in 63. Uh-huh. Again, it was one of those things. He was, I mean, Celtic historically have always never been able to secure good goalkeepers. I know we have, obviously, you know, in recent times we have, but, you know, we three goalkeepers.
There was never a priority, was it?
No, not even under Jock's team. We just couldn't seem to sign a goalkeeper. And as I said, John Fallon was around then as well. So I think he went to Swindon, Frank, I think. But he had a lot of real poor games. He was a bit of a joke. Just one final point in the 93 game, I remember. I mean, he was such a big hero. I mean, I remember coming out of Mass on the Sunday after that destruction at Wembley, and the priest, Father Denneke, who was from Kirk, wound me up basically when we came out having a go at me, and I was less than pleasant to him, and I was forced to apologise.
Mm-hmm. What parish was that?
St Luke's in Ballot Street.
Ballot Street, yeah.
Yeah. So I had to apologise to him because he was winding me up about Frank Linton and all these goals.
That's the John Dunn Scotus, isn't it?
John Dunn Scotus, where the bones of St Valentine are, allegedly. Mm-hmm. There's a boxer there, right, whether the bones are in it or not, I don't know, but that's
So is that the same building then?
No. The old St Luke's church is now, it wasn't actually, you know, the school was above it. Mm-hmm. St Luke's school was above it, that was the primary I went to, and the ground floor, if you lower floor, if you like, was a church, but it was just a big rectangular building. It wasn't church like. And it got knocked down. The only bit remaining is actually the old church house, which is now a home, I think, which is directly opposite the Gorbals Sports Centre.
So we're here to discuss the Gorbals, and more importantly discuss the links with Celtic and the history of Celtic fans in the Gorbals. So Gorbals is an area, quite a rich area in history of Glasgow, famous for probably football and boxing.
Yeah.
But we do have to say, you know, something of a bad reputation that got on the back of that book that came out, No Mean City, in the 1930s. So, you being a Gorbals born and bred, would that be unfair to the area?
Probably not. I mean, obviously that was done in the 30s, but I think it's fair to say it was widely acknowledged that Gorbals was almost like a ghetto, if you like. The housing conditions were terrible, you know, outside toilets, you know, slum back courts, and there were gangs, you know, certainly when I was growing up, there was a few gangs at Cumbie, were one of them. Obviously there was one notorious character that most Glaswegians will know about. It was Boyle. Jimmy Boyle.
Jimmy Boyle, who, I have to say, right into the 1990s, had an executive box at Parkhead.
I think I narrowly missed one of his, I don't have to say allegedly, because I think he was convicted for this murder in 1968, but one of my friends stayed up sort of the close that he committed this murder, apparently. And there's what Ian Brady, the Moors murderer, was a Gorbals boy as well.
I did a wee bit of research and I found something I'm not sure you know.
Yeah.
Mickey Rooney's dad was born on a Gorbals.
I think I've heard that one before. I mean,
his name was Yule, so it was. Yule. It wasn't Rooney, it was Yule.
I kind of think I've heard that before. Yeah, I mean, getting back to the point about it being a rough place, it was rough, but kind as well, in a sort of strange kind of way. You know, the old adage, we could leave the door open and everybody knew everybody else, and they helped each other. But it certainly had a bad reputation, and the conditions were, you know, they were poor, you know, outside toilets and people living in single ends and all the rest of it, you know, dampness and all sorts of stuff. So, challenging at times to be brought up.
So what kind of childhood would you have then, growing up in the 50s and 60s?
Before I was born, the family lived in the Oatlands, but when I was born, we were living Crown Street. We lived the top floor, and it was me and my two brothers, John and Jimmy, and my grandparents lived across the landing from us, and, you know, we had three. John, Jimmy and I shared a bedroom, basically. John and I shared a single bed, which was awkward at times. My dad was a fireman. My dad played for Clyde before the war, actually. And
sounds like a great community spirit.
There was. I mean, as I said, everybody, you knew not only everybody up your own close, you knew everybody up the next few closes. Strangely enough, because it was such a overpopulated area, I mean, I think it, certainly in the 30s and 40s, they're talking about between 90 and 100,000 people in the Gorbals. So even to venture a few streets away, it seemed a bit of an adventure, you know. And you got a bit wary about, you know,
certain streets.
Right. I don't know people are never here, and of course, you know, there was four Catholic churches in the Gorbals as well. There was St Luke's, which is only one remaining, although it's now in Don Scotus. There was St Francis with their own pipe band. There was St John's, and St Bonaventure's.
St John's Portugal Street.
St John's Portugal Street. Yeah. That was Charlie Gallagher's parish. So there was a big, you know, it was an immigrant community as well. You mean a lot of Highland folk. You had Italians, Lithuanians.
A lot of Jewish people as well.
Yes, we're going to say, I think probably the biggest Jewish population in Scotland at the time. Indeed, they had their own newspaper, the Jewish Chronicle. There was a synagogue in the Gorbals, I'm sure, and they had another administrative office in Thistle Street, I believe. So it was a sort of hodgepodge, but overwhelmingly there was a big Irish community, mostly from Donegal.
I was about to make the point there about the I think of all the areas of Glasgow, probably maybe the biggest influx came at the Gorbals, probably because of geography. If you're coming off at the Broom of Law,
the Derry Boat,
and you don't know where you're going, if you take a right turn, then you're there.
Yeah, exactly, and I think that was the reason for it. And of course, you know, once people were there and established, then, you know, we'd get the message, come over, and you know, they would join their relatives or their friends or whatever, you know. So without a doubt, it was
you mentioned something there that makes me curious, actually. Like, you were mentioning Oatlands. So places like Hutchison Town, Lauriston, Oatlands, are they just posh names for areas of the Gorbals, do you think?
Well, probably not. If you talk to people of Oatlands, they'll probably say no. Hutchison Town certainly is. It was to the west, the east, if you like, of Crown Street. And Lauriston is actually a bar there just now, which is one bar of the year, I think.
Lauriston Bar.
Lauriston. So it was, I suppose you could call that the Greater Gorbals. But to me, Gorbals was, you know, Crown Street, Thistle Street, Florence Street, Ballot Street, which used to be called Govan Road. Being a Govan man. You may know that. Hospital Street, Cumberland Street, Camden Street, Rutherglen Road, etc. That was kind of the heart of it.
So let's move on to the supporters clubs and the buses and stuff. I'm going to, I'll call a, I know you, you've got a, I see you've got a big list there, but I'm going to go through a couple here and the more common ones, and then you can go on the other ones. So the first one I've got down here is it Glenties or Glenties?
The Glenties, yep, the Glenties. You can't talk about the Glenties. It was a village in Donegal, and the Glenties was really, when you talk about the Glenties, you talk about Gorbals, you talk about Celtic supporters, you talk about a guy called Joe Gallagher. I don't know if you've heard of Joe.
Joe was
Mr. Celtic. In fact, he actually officially was Mr. Celtic.
He was on a few DVDs through the years, wasn't he?
Videos
and stuff.
Joe worked in the railways, and he ran the Glenties. Now, whether it was a supporters club as we know supporters clubs with members, I don't know if it was quite like that, because it was on Glenties bus a lot, although it changed its name and it's now.
So where would that have left for then?
The Glenties, they left for Benny's Bar, which was right on Gorbals Cross. I mean, the Gorbals had pubs at every single corner. More. And Benny's Bar was where one of the places they left from. Now, Joe, it would not only run one bus, it would run two double deckers to Celtic Park. And as I said, Joe was Mr. Celtic. I mean, I remember before the 69 Cup final, I think, I saw Joe wear a sort of small kind of briefcase, and he opened it, and it was ram packed with Cup final tickets. That's where the Glenties ran from. It was really, people would call it Joe Gallagher's bus. Joe actually used to be in the Sarsfield, which was our old club. That's where he started. But he branched out the Glenties, and he moved around a few pubs, which might cover in a minute. And Joe himself lived in Tory Glen, Kerry Floyd Place. And he ran buses everywhere, you know. And he ran buses to Wembley too. I was on his buses to Wembley a few times. And he also ran concerts in the St Mungo Halls, which is along Ballater Street.
There's one, actually, there's a guy for Govan, who told me a story years ago that after we won the European Cup, the Franciscans had a concert in St Mungo's Halls. And when the curtain went back, there was one of the brothers on a big sort of tall stool. And he had a sort of cassock on that was hanging down the front. And he started playing this song on a guitar, and people were thinking, what's going on here? And he was having a laugh, and they lifted his cassock up, and underneath it was the European Cup.
Well, yeah, I can
the whole place
it.
Went mental.
Yeah, well, couple of stories about that as well. Joe was so influential. I mean, he was well in at Celtic Park, and but Joe didn't have a car. And I remember December 65, we'd won so we had the Scottish Cup and the League Cup and the sideboards at Celtic Park. And Joe phoned, contacted my dad and said, look, I want to take these cups up to Mearnskirk to show the patients. So we went up to Celtic Park, picked the two cups up
in the motor,
in the car, took them to Mearnskirk, showed the patients, and my dad said, well, what are we going to do, take them back to Celtic Park? Just said, no, well, just hang on them now and take them back later. And we had them in our house for about 4 or 5 hours. But that's the thing they did. Then people, you know, lent out cups, and you would have them at functions, and you know, all the Celtic dignitaries would come to all these functions, including Joe's. In fact, he had one of the things Joe did, he always had a St. Patrick's celebration do in St. Mungo's, and it was Glenn Daly with the compere, and whoever was the latest Irish.
One thing we have to say at this point here, for people that maybe don't know the area or don't remember St. Mungo's Halls, what a beautiful building.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And you know, I remember it right up to the 1980s when they knocked it down. That was a crime.
It's shocking that Glasgow generally are being destroyed and knocked down. It was just ridiculous. But Joe used to have these concerts, and they would usually be for the benefit of the Franciscan African missions. And he had one in 1966 that was for the Golden Jubilee, the Easter Rising. And the sort of the running order was a colour party, the reading of the Easter Week proclamation in the last post.
Wow.
And then followed by, you'll like this, Govan Emerald's float bands.
Yeah,
because I think I heard last week.
I know a couple of guys that were in the Govan Emerald.
Yeah, well, they were there with it. You used to have the Coat Bridge accordion band and all that stuff. So all that stuff in on St. Mungo Halls.
Good to know.
And they were a good sing song. I think, I'm pretty sure, I remember being at a few of them. I think even the early 60s, Frank Halfie was at one in time. As Frank as you know did sing as he on the B side of Celtic sang Slattery's Mounted Foot. So I'm pretty sure Frank sang that, but yeah, Joe the Glenties was,
that was his bus.
It was his bus, and it was named after that the area. And
that's interesting. So moving on one to Sarsfield, which I believe is you know well.
Yes, well, Sarsfield was my dad's club basically.
When did that start then?
Well, you know, we've still got quite a lot of records. I've got minutes here and all that, get back to the early 60s and stuff, but at that time there was an old guy in the club called Tommy Sherlock. Tommy was an old man even in the 60s, still travelled to the games, and he was the guy that told me the story of the Sarsfield banner, how it was captured from the...
Was this the one that was off the Orange Walk?
Yeah, we'll come on to that in a minute. Yeah, as far as the name's concerned, we don't really know why they chose that name, but it's interesting. I looked at a lot of the clubs then, it was like the Glenties, or it was...
It was a great nationalist hero, Sarsfield.
Well, this is it. He's fucking Billy, basically. You know, that's a plus point right away. So I suppose that was why the name was chosen. But interesting, if a lot of the clubs about the Gobs at that time were like, and indeed wider, people just would call it, you know, Springburn number one or Kinloch or you know, whatever. But occasionally you would have Emerald or Shamrock at the end of it. But Sarsfield was a specific name to in commemoration of a guy. But the Sarsfield started way, way, way back. And if MD has seen the photograph of the Brake Club, they'll know it goes back to that time. And the bus left from a tavern, which was on the corner of Florence Street and Ballater Street. And my dad was the busking for a long time. Another sort of eminent guy in the Sarsfield was John McFadden, who started the
Celtic Films.
John was in the club.
Actually, John McFadden worked in the National Savings Bank at Cow Glen, and John was in there. He died very young, I think.
It's tragic. Yeah, John died. He did die. I mean, you know, God, I'm 65 now, but John might not even have been 65 when he died. It's terrible. You know,
I had it in my mind he was in his 50s, you know.
It could have been actually. I was really shocked.
It was a big shock at the time when he passed away.
He wasn't a heavy drinker, if I drink at all or whatever. And John was a real administrator. And you can see when you read back in the minutes and all that stuff, he was a real administrator. Really ran the club, the administrative side of the club, really, really well. So my dad actually got him to join the club, and he was there till, you know, right up to the mid 70s or so, you know. But he was another kind of eminent guy. The Sarsfield, I mean, you know, we ran buses to all the games, home and away. And famously in, you know, 67, my dad announced that we would be chartering a plane, which caused a few alarm bells to start with, but he managed to fill it, and he did the same again in Milan 3 years later. And the banner, going back to that, it only made two appearances at games that I can recall. One was at 65 in Sunderland, when we won 5-0. And then at Liverpool that infamous 66. Night, and get back to the old guy, Tommy Sherlock. Tommy was an old sort of rebel, and so we took the banner to Liverpool, and they started marching from Lime Street, you know, along the street with his banner, you know, carrying all sorts of things. Tommy's at the front. It was a long way to Anfield for there, so the next minute Tommy's on the local corporation bus getting up to the game. But it got taken into the ground, the banner, you know. And unfortunately, when the disaster struck at the end of the game, which, as you know, the worst, where we got a goal chopped off, and
there was a wee mini riot at the end in terms of the bottles.
Well, that was cans. It was one of the scariest things I've ever been in my life, because it was, you know, it wasn't just one or two bottles; it was
full end.
It was, you know, the anger.
There's a famous photo. I know you've seen it. The bottles were in the perimeter Anfield three times.
And I think famously, Shankly having a joke with Jock Steen saying, you know, you're about to make a lot of money in the empties or whatever it was, but yeah, it was.
I think he said, "Do you want half the gate money, or do you want empties?"
I mean, empties. That's right. Yeah,
because that might be there.
I know. I mean, that was sort of classic, you know, Celtic stuff. It was a disaster. We, you know, the banner get blooming upended. The driver we got, we had a Cotter's bus in, who were the company that Celtic used. The guy got lost on the way back, and we ended up, we ran out of petrol about 30 miles from Glasgow. And of course, on the Saturday we came back and we won the Scottish Cup final.
That's right, Rangers,
and it was nothing easy, of course. So
sadly, you know, obviously the horribles in terms of the population decline and stuff like that. When did the Sarsfield end?
Well, it kind of ended and it didn't end, kind of thing. You're right, the Gorbals sort of went from a, you know, ghetto in through the 70s, early part of the 70s, as you're saying, that, you know, that it just, everything was getting knocked down, including all the pubs and all that. The last minutes I've got are from 73. In fact, we had a player of the year dance in the Whitehall in Renfrew Street, I think it was. But by that time it was like the Last Supper, there's only about, you know, 10 of us left, and we sat waiting in Dixie Deans to turn up, because he was a player of the year, and he didn't, you know. And that was kind of the end. We actually, you know, it's happened when a lot of the supporters' clubs and the golfers and the pubs get knocked down, you kept moving to other places. So, you know, we moved to a few places, and eventually we just kind of ran out. Took its toll, and we ended up, we travelled in Joe Gallagher's bus, which then became, I think it had become the James Stokes by that time.
So that's quite interesting. So the James Stokes that we know now, leaving for the Brazen Head, originally it was Gallagher's bus.
Yeah, because they still pick up in Kerry Croy and Tony Glenn now, and they come down, and it's, yeah, James Stokes. I mean, there was a bus also at that time left from the Gary on. Joe's bus might even have left from there as well. And I think what you found in the Gobbles was, back to the sort of the heyday of it, was there was pubs everywhere. They were all Celtic friendly, but there wasn't a lot of pubs had Celtic buses, so people were going to the game, we were going to Joe Gallagher's bus, or we're going to Sarsfield.
Right.
So there might have been dozens and dozens of pubs, but there was maybe only, you know, 15, 20 supporters clubs or whatever. But so that, you know, the James Stokes now certainly is, if you like, the modern equivalent of
I didn't know that is interesting. So what about Evergreen then? I remember the Evergreen bus.
Yeah, well, Evergreen, really, that's what we are now, together, to tell us now, called Jimmy Cowan Evergreen after my dad, because when the Sarsfield kind of ran out,
disbanded,
there's still a few of us, we still all went to the games all the time, and we were told, look, there's a good bus runs out of the Glen Bar in Pulitzer's Road. Norrie Douglas was the owner, and at that time Johannes Advilsen had just signed for Celtic, so Big Shuggy was in there. That club was called Johannes Advilsen Celtic Supporters Club. So a few of us joined that, but it only really lasted 2 or 3 years, and I remember the owner, Norrie, said to me, look, he gave me a Pantella cigar tin, and said, there's the funds. It was £495 in the thing, so I was charged the funds of the club. So we more or less right away we changed the name to Evergreen. There was a wee discussion, you know, I was I was kind of for calling it the Sarsfield again, but we thought, look, move on, turn over a new leaf, and we kind of called it the Evergreen, and that's really where the Evergreen.
So you could say that the Sarsfield moved on to the Evergreen, if you like.
That's what I would say. Yes, I would say so, absolutely. And then when my dad died in December 97, and at the next meeting, the guy said, look, we want to call it Jimmy Cowan Evergreen. So that's the official title.
So where does it leave it in?
Now, we leave from the bottom of Pollockshaws Road at Cumberland Street for home games, just across from just outside Lipton's. In fact, when Lipton's was open, we used to go in there, but unfortunately, it closed down. So we don't really have a pub as such. For away games, we share with the Dean Park, who run out of Harry's. Used to be Kelly's Harry's. They split their time about so long to Kelly's. It's now some other pub, but you're not even allowed to. They don't accept cash or something like that. They change days. But that's who we share with to go to all the away games. And the clubs are very similar, in as much as it. You know, people sit and read the book or read the paper or read tablets and they sing songs or the music and then that. So the Evergreen for a long while were called the Graveyard Bus because we were so born. And interestingly, while we're on, I looked out the constitution of the Sarsfield.
What year was that, sir?
I reckon this is the late 50s, 60s. Under item 7, it says members and friends can travel on bus. Any person hanging from window, cursing or swearing, or singing party tunes will be dismissed from the bus, no matter what distance from home. So you can just imagine we're beating Aberdeen at Pittodrie and somebody starts singing
out?
The Rebels. I think it's quite indicative because I think in the old days the break clubs really were, you know, the break clubs were kind of. League of the Cross, I think.
That's right,
sort of thing. So that's probably goes back to those days. So they might have a problem.
So what about Gorbals Emerald?
The Gorbals Emerald were another bus. You know something, I'm not 100% sure what pub they left from. It might have been the Clelland. They were around in the late 60s, early 70s. I'm not 100% sure what pub they left from. I mentioned the Clelland there because obviously there was a serious incident there.
The bomb
at the Clelland.
Well, thankfully nobody was injured in it. So.
No, five people. There was another attempt a couple. That was 79 that happened at Clelland.
I remember that well.
In 77,
was it Derry Trainers?
Derry Trainers, because one of the guys in our bus, I think his uncle was in the pub with Derry Trainer. Time the guy kicked up the guy the package was kicked down the street so it didn't explode and it affected the the guy in your club's I'm sure it's his uncle he's hearing, but the Clelland one was serious stuff because they'd done the old Barnes Bar as well and of course the guys were involved were notorious.
Well, but the father was linked the son that murdered the boy at Rigdon Cross in 1995. So you're talking about a nasty.
If I can be allowed to tell a story about Brigton Cross, and this, I think this should go on my tombstone. I think because I was in the Mermaid was
a notorious. Notorious.
You know, my dad was from Brigton. He was a secret heart man, big Celtic man from Brigton, so he knew about these people. But my claim to fame is that I was in the Mermaid with a Celtic scarf on.
You got away with it.
I'd love to tell the tale. And what happened was. It was before the Celtic Benfica European Cup tie.
69?
Yes, it was a reserve game at Celtic Park. In the old days, if you remember, they used to sell the tickets for European games. Yep, so I thought we'll go up to the game, me and my mate Alfie Pike. So we go to the game, the reserve game, and I was wearing one of these, the wee bottle green scarf that we wore then. So, and I had my plane for Celtic, I had bought that in the town, my plane for Celtic Book. Number, whatever it was. So. And you think back and you think, why the hell did you ask? Why did you not just go another way? But there was something about you thought, look, I need to go back to Gorbals, so I'm going to go by Brigton Cross.
A flashpoint for Celtic fans.
Well, I mean, I've got a list of things that happened to us there. I was assaulted more than once there, as some of my mates were. And the bus was attacked as well. But on this particular day, the reserve game finishes, we run down London Road, and we get to Brigton Cross to think, right, we need to get through here quickly. Mm-hmm. So we're running on the opposite side from the Mermaid, and there was a bookies there. So we're running, and this guy steps out of the bookies and just bangs me one in the side of the head, punched it, you know. So I'm a 16-year-old boy, a 15-year-old boy, and he's a, you know, 40-year-old man. So I went, I was sent flying over the road, ripped on my trousers, cut on my knee. I'm playing for Celtic, came out with paper, landed at his feet. I remember getting up saying to him, can I get my book back, mister? And he went, come and get it, yeah, Fenian so and so. And he kicked me, kicked the book back to me. And all credit, I met Alfie, he said, come on. And we ran around Londresy Street, and we Alfie got hold of a policeman who had a walkie talkie, and I was like, he's just been assaulted, blah 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 blah. So the next minute there's a woman, you know, Black Mariah, whatever it is, and a sort of three or four police, and they said, well, what happened? We told them, and Alfie went, he went in there, he went into the Mermaid. So the police took Alfie and I into the Mermaid. I've still got a Celtic scarf on at the time,
picking out.
Aye, and this guy's sitting playing dominoes. And so they grabbed him, they put him in the back, they put us in the front, took us to Tobago Street police station. And remember, we got in and I had the scarf and I put my book, put it in the table, and the big sergeant, desk sergeant, looking at us, asked a few questions, and he picked up my scarf and he went, did you have this on? And I went, well, I did. And he went, what did you bloody expect?
I deserved it.
That was it. But that's my claim to fame. I've been in the Mermaid with a Celtic scarf on.
So the Horrible's Emerald then, there was a famous film that a German guy made in the 70s about the old firm.
Yes.
And it goes in, and the reason why I say this is that it's right. A pub in the Gorbals. Yes. And I'm going to ask you which one it is.
Aye.
But the Gorbals, it came up that the guy was a convener of the government. Yeah. Ricky Jackson or something.
Ricky, yeah.
Now, so what pub
was
that?
I say the Clown. You know, it might have been the Govan Hill bar. It might have been the Govan Hill bar. Or it could have been the Blanest. I remember seeing that, but I honestly don't know. Yeah, they were definitely around at that time. But I don't know what pub that was.
Because there was something quite sad in the 80s that when I became of age, it was like an old guy called Jack McTiernan. He came for the Gorbals originally. He took me into Derry Trainers.
Yeah.
The Blarney Stone was nearby, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And it was like two teeth and a myth, a gumsy myth. Do you know what I mean? It was this big area, and all that sat there was these two pubs. It was quite depressing.
Well, it's totally. You know, even the Blarney Stone was still there in the '90s, and it was like, you know, standing its own, and it was, you know, it was a good pub to go to after the games if you'd want to, you know, you'd win the game and stuff like that. But the '90s were depressing enough in the early '90s.
Well, Jack's argument was, you get guys coming for Castlemilton places like that because they felt a connection to the area,
absolutely,
and they wanted to, even though there was nothing there, you know, or nothing much left.
Yeah, I know. Of course, you know, a lot of people for the Gorbals when they get moved, a lot of people. The Gorbals ended up in Castlemore, of course, as well, you know. So
do you want to mention there's one other one, obviously, there's a James Stokes, which we've touched on.
Yes.
So all the clubs that I recall we've mentioned, but I know you've got
there was a James Welsh club who were around for a long time in the 60s and the 70s. They actually left from the Granite City, which is now the Brazenhead. So they
were the original bus for the Brazenhead.
They were
the
original bus for the Brazenhead, but as I said, they called it the Granite City at the time. There was also another pub called the Holly Tree, which was up Hospital Street. I always get my streets mixed up, Hospital Street or Thistle Street. So that was another supporting club, and they just called themselves that. In fact, that was Camden Street, which was just off Rutherglen Road, but that actually used to be called South Shamrock Street, apparently. And then in old Rutherglen Road, where they built the new flats and all that stuff, there was the Phoenix and the Elizabethan. Buses used to run out of there, and then there was a corner bar as well, which was up beside Derry Trainers and the Blarney Stone. They used to have a wee bus, St Mungo Bar, along beside St Mungo Halls. They had the Blarney Stone had a bus. Now I'm not quite sure what club it was, because people did, the buses used to move about the pubs, you know, as they shut down, but I don't think that lasted for that long. And of course, I've already mentioned, but it's worth another mention, I think the Gary Owen, which was in Norfolk Street, just off of Gobbles Cross. And I think Joe Gallagher's bus ran from there for a while. But again, I think Joe's buses were, you know, always there every game. And I think some of these other clubs
came and went,
you know. And of course, once the pub started going, it was a lot more difficult to keep going, membership and all that fell, people moved away. And I don't know if I mentioned before, the Phoenix as well. Phoenix was another pub, just think of Rutherglen Road or something like that, where they had a club. At the moment, actually, there's only in the Gobbles, there's only ourselves, the James Stokes, the Brazen, who leave from the Brazen Head. And there's another wee bus who leave from either the park sometimes in Lipton's car park, or just at the back of Brazen Head there's a wee minibus with some guys in it. I'm not quite sure, you know, historically where they
came from.
That's all. And
there's bound to be a link with somewhere.
Oh absolutely. And a lot of, some of them are quite older guys and all that, so they might be old James Welsh guys or from Elizabethan or something like that.
So the 65 Scottish Cup final was the turning point for Celtic, and the older Celtic fans always made me aware of it, and I've seen photos as well. The trip back to Hampden with the Celtic bus apparently went through the Gorbals, and it took something like 2 hours to get through it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great photograph. I mean, my brother John made a great scrapbook of that season. It's one of those things, he started making them and it turned out great because it was a great photograph taken, and it's in front of the High Bar, which is the top of Cry Street, and the bus just get totally enveloped with the Celtic support because
they move.
No, they couldn't, because I mean, it was, you know, it was the turning point, as everyone knows, and it was just engulfed. And they were obviously making their way into the city centre with the cup, but it was just, you know, a fantastic night. I think everyone was more pulling the wings, turned out, you know.
Did you see that person?
Yeah, I was there, and actually, it was a great one of the reasons we kept the photograph, because my mum's in the photograph. You see her woman getting caught up just in front of the bus. And as I said, it was, you know, more pulling the wings. It was like, you know, I think everybody knew it was something special that happened, you know. Because I remember 4 years before, amazingly enough, Dunfermline came down with the cup down Crown Street. But it went by, like, you know, a jiffy, because nobody wanted to film it. See, of course, when the beat is
there's one wee story just came into my head there. The old guy Jack that I worked with, he was a character. He came for Cumberland Street, and he says that in the night of the 66 European Cup Winners' Cup final, Liverpool played Dortmund. Now, apparently, it was an awful night, a right howler, wind and rain. You know, it was terrible. And he said that he was standing at the corner at don't mind the Cumberland Street, but this would have been because it was a big street. And a Liverpool bus come down on the way to Hampden, because they've obviously either got lost or they're not sure in the weather where they're gone. And he swears blind that the on this Liverpool bus there was a big flag and it said "fuck the Pope" on it. And Jack says, "I swear," he says, "by the time that bus left Cumberland Street, there wasn't a one day left in it."
I've never heard that story before, but it was a kind of gathering point, because I remember.
He called them corner boys.
There was
always boys hanging about the corner.
Well, absolutely. Well, another
not really doing anything wrong, but no, you know, up to niggle at the same time.
Right. Well, after the 1963 replay when we lost 3-0 the Rangers, that was total humiliation that night, when, you know, there wasn't many Celtic supporters left at the end. Because it was a major thoroughfare that came down for Hampden.
That's
so
right.
I remember being there that night, and of course, there was crowds milling all over the place. Celtic have got beat, and there was a scooter came down with two Rangers supporters on it. And one of the guys who I'm not naming him, but I still see him walking up and down here to this day. He decided he was going to try and grab the guy off the scooter. So this guy who's on the scooter, the driver, starts accelerating, and this guy's hanging onto the back, the Celtic supporter, trying to
knock him off.
Got him off, and I always remember the sparks flying through his shoes, you know. But the guy got away. But yeah, it was you know, those were the days, as I say, because you know, the buses did come down that way from Hampden. That was but the Liverpool story, I've never heard that before.
Just a random bus that, you know, pure fate. They've took a wrong turn or maybe get confused. In a wet and windy night.
I mean, the message wouldn't be a surprise, because I know Liverpool. There's a big love in the Celtic Liverpool. Not so much the game in 66, but I was at the 74 testimonial, Ron Yates testimonial. Our group happened to be at the Hemlin Road stand right at the Co-op. And Celtic were 3 up after about half an hour, and they threw absolutely everything at us. You know, all sorts of stuff. There were Celtic fans in that end, got back there doing as well.
There might have been bad blood for the 66 game, considering the riot and stuff like that.
Possibly, I know.
Well, let's move on to players then, because... you'll know better than me, actually. So the first one I'm going to mention is Tommy Docherty, who might not spring to mind immediately. But the reason why there's an interesting story about Tommy Docherty. 10 years ago or so, I went to the Citizens Theatre, and it was at a basically a talking with the Doc, as they call him. And he got quite emotional because he was from the area before he moved to Shettleston. And he spoke about St Francis Boys Guild and he remembered the priests and everything. But there's an interesting wee addition that night because I'm trying to remember who was interviewing him now. I think it might have been, actually, I think it may have been Hugh McIlvany. I can't remember. Somebody quite, was he just a normal journalist? He was quite a highfalutin journalist. And Celtic had just drawn Man United the Champions League. And he says, well, Tommy, you know, ex Celtic player, ex Man United manager, you know, who will we be rooting for during that game? He says, who is it you think will win, right? And he said, truthfully, and he went, aye. He says, well, the head tells you Manchester United, he says, but the heart, and he said, always the heart will always be for Celtic. He says, even after all these years, he says, when he managed all these teams in England, he says, the first thing I ever did this Saturday night was to either get a television or get a newspaper just to hear how Celtic got on, because he says it was such an important part of your life. And he actually, again, he was getting quite emotional about thinking about it, and he said something quite prophetic, because obviously Celtic won over the two, well, technically they won over the two legs, 3-2 down there and 1-0 here. And he says I have a gut feeling, he says, that Celtic are going to edge it. And I remember thinking at the time, it's a bit optimistic.
I know. Yeah, well, actually, well, Tommy Docherty was certainly one of the ones in my list, although you're right, he wasn't in the Gobbles, I don't think, for a long time. He's a good age now as well, he's 92.
Well, he's reckoned to be the oldest living Celtic player.
He must be.
In his 90s.
Aye, he must be. And I think he only made about 8 or 9 appearances or something like that for Celtic. But yeah, certainly, I think there's lots of Celtic players and lots of ex-guys that came from the Gobbles who still profess to be Celtic fans, but really you wonder if they are. But certainly Tommy Docherty, I think anything I've heard him talk about Celtic, he always does seem genuinely still a Celt, if you like. The other one I've got, of course, the obvious one is Paddy Cairns.
Yeah, well, obviously, I mean, you can't mention the Gormals without
Pat. No, not at all, because Pat, well, Pat, not only was he, I mean,
synonymous with the Gormals.
Absolutely, he lived up the road from us. He was a St Luke's boy, he went to Holyrood as well, which a lot of us did. And the there was a couple of occasions, actually, because not a lot of people in the Gobbles with a car, but my dad had a car, and he drank smoke and I liked a car, and Paddy used to have to get public transport to Celtic Park, you know, sort of get the trolley bus along
the tram
cross and all that stuff. And Paddy was always late. He was always late, and there were a few occasions my dad sort of saw Paddy shuffling about try to catch the bus and all that, and he gave him a lift up to Celtic Park. The other thing,
can you imagine getting along and seeing Scott Brown waiting for a bus?
No, definitely not. Probably had a chauffeur or something like that. But that was Paddy, obviously. But the St Louis Boys Guild is probably worth a mention, because the guys that ran that were real, they were great volunteers, because they ran a brilliant boys guild. Paddy went to it. They had a Paddy Cairn Cup that we used to play for every year, and these guys that ran it, Billy Wallace, his name was Tom Daly Senior, another guy called Albert Boyd, they ran the St Luke's, and it was a result of, you know, the structure, if you like, and the premises and everything that these guys did that was able to enabled guys like Paddy and somebody might talk about in a minute, Jim McAllog as well, to benefit from. The other thing about St Luke's was that the Celtic Boys Club used to come and change in there before they would go along and play at Glasgow Green. But Paddy certainly, I would think deep down he's still a big Celtic guy.
Well, the thing about Paddy Cairns is it's quite a sad story, because for such a great player he didn't have great success, and again he was synonymous with a failing Celtic team.
That's right.
And the irony is, the Milton, remember my dad saying this, Bobby Murdoch might never have came to the fore if Paddy was right half.
Well, that's true. Although Paddy, I think, reckons that Bobby Murdoch was a better player. Paddy was slow, but a great pass for the ball and stuff like that, obviously.
My dad wouldn't have ceded to anybody with Bobby. He thought Bobby was above all.
I kind of agree with that. There's a couple of, a good story that Mick Jackson tells about Paddy Cairn. You know, Mick Jackson was a contemporary of his, and Mick Jackson's still a big friend of Big Billy's, and he was Mick was a neighbour of my older brother Jimmy as well, and I remember Mick telling us that the story of the New Year's Day game at Ibrox when Celtic lost 4-0. That was the day, of course, it kind of...
It all came ahead that day, didn't it? Yeah, Mick Sean.
Yeah, but the bit I didn't know, and Mick was obviously there on the day, he wasn't playing, but he said at half time when the thing kicked off, Paddy just said that he'd done a kind of Mark Ruddocker, if you like, that's it, I'm not going back out, and actually ran the bath and went into the bath, and he refused to go back out, and Mick Jackson had to say to him, look, you better get back out there, because we're getting, don't have substitutes or anything like that. So of course he ended up getting beat 4-0. The rest, as I say, is history. Another wee story that Mick told about Paddy, because he was a bit of a fiery character, was the five-a-side he used to hold at Falkirk. He gets sent off more or less right away, but one of the reasons that happened, according to Mick, is that, you know, they're all in the dressing room with other teams, and some guy comes in, one of the Falkirk players I think it was, and made a derogatory comment about Celtic stroke Catholics, and I think it kicked off with Jim Kennedy or somebody throwing their boot at this guy, and so they got it, and the game kicks off, and within about 2 minutes Paddy gets sent off for taking retribution, you know. So it was quite a fiery character. He actually came, we had a bus run to Burnt Island to Sarsfield, maybe in about 1960. I've got a photograph somewhere. Paddy and his wife Nora, I think her name was, came on the
Noreen.
So they came on the bus to the bus run, you know.
Jeez, oh.
Those were the days.
So that gives us a good link on to Charlie Gallagher, because Charlie and Pat are related through marriage, I believe. I can't remember if it's Pat's mammy or Charlie's mammy married twice,
that's
a connection.
Well, Charlie was a St John's boy as opposed to Paddy being a St Luke's boy, and Charlie was involved in some of the greatest moments in Celtic's history, of course, you know. But you know, and we're being cruel here, but people, you know, fans can be, you know, very demanding at times, and Charlie
wasn't a tackler, was he?
No, he wasn't a tackler. Harry Hood got that as well, you know.
Tommy Callaghan guys.
Tommy Callaghan, you got a list of guys like that, but Charlie was a great football player. He probably his best spell was second half of the 67-68 season.
Yeah, when Berry
got injured. And Charlie had a great, you know, 3 or 4 months and was outstanding. And of course, well, one of the weirdest goals I've ever seen in my life was the first equaliser in the 65 Cup final.
Is that the one at the bar?
It's the bar.
Wow.
You know, it's just big.
Look at the height of it there.
I mean, straight up and straight down, you know. And of course, he delivered the corners and the corner.
Well, talking about the corners, I interviewed Charlie for a podcast about 2-3 years back.
Yeah.
He was in good form, and he said, you know, he said, for years, he says, all people would come up to me and go, Charlie, you took that corner in 65 and you took the corner with Wadsworth Dean. And he says, I used to get quite upset. He says, because, he says, they'll only remember me for two things.
I know.
He says, but you know something? He says, as I got older in life, he says, I'm happy to be remembered for two things.
Yeah.
He says, I'm actually quite proud of my contributions, even in a very, very small way.
Yeah, I mean, he was still a really good player, but I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, the corners he took were, you know, never be forgotten.
So was Tony McBride a Gorbals boy?
Tony McBride, well, I suppose we're
originally
talking on about Gorbals, Oatlands. Tony, I think, was Rosebery Street, which so really that's the Oatlands. You know, Rosebery Park was is now, I don't know what it is, it's a nuclear zone, I think. I don't know what's in there, but he used to stay in Rosebery Street, I think, so he would, strictly speaking, he was not on my list, but
Paul Dykes had the great book about the Quality Street gang. And I remember my dad and his friends talking in later years about how he was to be the next Jimmy Johnson. And I remember Paul Dykes' book, something obviously that sticks to my mind. 38 clubs wanted to sign that boy.
I know.
Every major club in Britain, apart from one.
Yeah.
Which was, you know who, but the name Anthony McBride, you weren't going to go far up there.
Of course not, no.
But to think that, you know, every major team, the big Manchester teams, the London teams, the Liverpool teams, Celtic.
Yeah.
And he had the choice of them all.
Aye, but he went the way a lot of young guys go, unfortunately. But he was, I would say, an Oatlands boy at Rosebery Street. One other guy I've got, he's a St Francis boy, was John Carrella.
Oh, right.
John Carrella. John Carrella.
Centre half.
You know, because people used to say, oh, you know, you get McNamee, Cushley, and Carrella, you know, blooming street fighters. He only played a couple of games, right enough. I think he ended up at Northampton or something like that.
So apparently, and you'll know better than me, Carrella the Gorilla.
I mean, he was pretty fearsome looking character, John, you know.
Have you read Alec Ferguson's book? The only reason why I say this is that in the beginning, you know, in the when he's talking about being a young guy playing the game, and he says that the hardest halfback line I ever saw was a Celtic reserve halfback line. Is it McNamee,
Kirillah,
or whatever order they came in? And Alec Ferguson, he's been a bit jocular, but at the same time, he's saying, honest to God, he says these three guys, but the devil would have turned their man.
Well, they were
hard men,
tough cookies. I mean, John Cushley, famously, I would say, done better against the Rangers, James Forrest.
Yes.
Only one James Forrest.
And Billy did.
Billy did, but the day we beat them 5-1 at New Year of 66, John Cushley was at 6.5 against Forrest. Big Billy had a particularly bad time. But yeah, John Carroll was another guy. Another player I've got is Joe Bailey.
Oh, right, for the 50s.
Yeah, Joe Bailey. Now, the reason I've got this is because I don't think he was originally a Gorbals boy, but I'm fairly certain he lived in the Gorbals. I'm pretty sure he lived in the Gorbals in Rutherglen Road, I believe. He tragically died in the mid-60s in a car crash at Kelvin, Bridge. Yeah,
That's
He played. He was basically an understudy to Bobby Evans. He played the 51 Cup Final, Joe Bailey. So he was a... as I said, maybe not originally a Gorbals boy, but lived there. And one other name I've got is a guy called Freddie Pethard.
Yeah, another one of the Quality Street.
Yeah, that's right, because it's a famous photograph of as I'm all at Glasgow Airport, they're all jumping up and all that stuff. And I remember looking at that, and it was only when I first saw that photograph and I thought, God, that's Freddie Pethard, because Freddie was a St Luke's boy. He was about 2.5, 3 years older than me, but he used to play football in the St Luke's yard, and even then you could see he was going to be a star, a really good, well, compared to the rest of us, he was going to be a really good football player. And he went to Celtic, but he never made it, and
that never really happened.
Wales somewhere, Cardiff, I think it was, but he never played a first team game or anything like that. He might have played a couple of reserve games, but because it was somebody that was kind of ages with me,
Well, there's a couple of fringe players, I mean, it was Brian Coyne,
who
played
Brian,
a game in the 70s.
Yeah, Brian Coyne.
We have to say, a friend of our family, my dad and his dad were friendly and worked together. Really Celtic mad family.
Celtic fanatics.
And you were saying that Brian's dad was with you in Lisbon.
But Brian's dad, John used to come in a Southfield bus and came with us to Lisbon. Fantastic. Yeah, great Celtic family. And Brian got to live the dream. Only one game written off against
Brian's story's quite sad, actually, because when Billy McNeil took over in the summer after he played under Jock's team, he got a bad injury. Now, it was a reserve game at Celtic Park. It goes to show how backward things were then, because Celtic didn't have a physio on the premises. So Brian's lying there with a broken leg. They had to phone an ambulance to come into the stadium to stretch them out of the stadium, and nobody went with him to the hospital. You imagine these days, you've got sports scientists, you've got physios, you've got doctors, you've got nutritionists and all these things. The reserve team didn't have anybody that was medically trained.
And that
was the late 70s.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if you ever saw the documentary that I think Purple TV did about Third Lanark, if you ever saw that, when Mick Jackson tells the story of it, the guy breaks his arm and the woman, Huddleston, I think it was, saying, make sure they don't cut that jersey, take that off.
We need that
jersey for next week. That was just a kind of, that was the old bucket of water and sponge days.
So there's another one here, Jamie McQuilkin. Would he have been a Gorbals boy?
Well, Jamie, I think Jamie, he played for St Johnstone as well, didn't he? I think Jamie, Jamie probably was a Gorbals boy. Whether he himself was born in the Gorbals, again, I'm not sure. I know some people that know him, so I don't know if he actually, he was more recent times, of course.
Yeah, he was in the 90s.
I know he played for St Johnstone, so I don't know if actually he would have been born in the Gorbals, Jamie, but he certainly had Gorbals connections and stuff.
And then we've got the one that got away, the Owen Coyle. A famous Gorbals family, as a player, because there was a time when Owen Coyle would have been better than anything we had.
I agree entirely, in fact, Owen, still see Owen round about. His brother still hangs about the Gorbals, I think, as well. And I think Owen's mother may even be in the Gorbals. But yeah, the Coyle family were big.
The last time I heard his mammy, she worked in the Citizens.
That's right, that's right, but I don't think she does that any longer. But yeah, he should have played for Celtic, there's no doubt. Absolutely, he was good enough to play, and the good thing about him, he kept himself fit as well, he was a goal scorer, but he escaped, and whether he did or did not get the chance to manage him, I don't know. Another name I've got, these are non-Celtic players now, of course. I know
you must have Frank McClintock.
That's my next name. Frank McClintock, because he is, his wee mammy lived in the Gobbles right up to her death. I think Frank was a Gobbles boy, big Celtic supporter. Although I know when Celtic played them, you know, in the qualifier, I think I read an article where he was saying, you know, that was my Celtic and my team, they're my heroes. But you know, as soon as you know the butts coming, you think, well, okay, tell me you'd want Arsenal to win, and that's really what he said was, you know, he's Arsenal through and through. So it's a bit like, you know, Paddy, where you thought Tommy Docherty rather than you're saying, you know, when Tommy Docherty's telling you he's still a Celtic man, yes he is. Frank, I think, you know, yes,
he's been away a long time. I mean, Frank must have left in the early 60s.
I did. I mean, he captained the Arsenal double winning team in 71. He played with Leicester as well, you know. So yeah, he's been away a long time, but he too was a Gobbles boy. And the other one, of course, a very famous one, Jim McAleog.
Jim, that's right.
Jim was a St Luke's boy, was an absolute outstanding player, Holyrood. And he, like Tony McBride, as you're saying, he had plenty of opportunities to go to join many teams, and it was decided he would go.
At least Jim had a career, you know, he had a fine career.
Yeah, yes, he did. So he's still around, he's kind of stuff.
Yeah, but I've met him a couple of times, a very nice man.
The reason, I've got two older brothers, but my next brother up, John, was kind of contemporary at Jim McAllog at the Gorbals, St Luke's. And Jim was, again, I think it was off the ball or something like that, and you could send in questions. And I sent him a question and saying, do you remember St Luke's? And, it was great. He said, yeah, I remember Tommy Daly. He mentioned all the guys who ran the club and all that stuff.
Nice to remember.
And it was really good to hear that, because he was so appreciative because of, you know, what they'd done for him, how they'd run the club and all that stuff. And it was good to hear him still remember that, you know.
One just came into my head there, Dennis Connigan.
Dennis.
Apparently, Dennis Connigan. I met Dennis Connigan, and he told me he stayed in Norfolk Street.
It's true.
And the building's still there, he says.
Well, Dennis was in the same school team as my older brother Jimmy. There's a great photograph in the Express of all the Holyrood teams. Dennis was in the Holyrood team along with my brother Jimmy. In fact, they played Barcelona youths in 1962 and get presented all this Barcelona stuff. So Dennis was a decent goalkeeper, and of course ended up at Celtic as well, you know.
Now, we can't mention the Gorbals without mentioning Benny Lynch.
Yes,
and Benny, God rest his soul, fought at Celtic Park, so there's a Celtic link there, and was known to be a Celtic fan as well. So it's quite interesting at the moment that they're trying to get a statue for him.
And
they're almost there, you know. They're doing really well, but there's a wee bit of controversy, I don't know if you know. There's discussion in where the statue should go. Now the first suggestion was Central Station, which I can see the point in some respects, because the volume of people coming in and out,
of course,
that's going to see the statue.
Yes.
The second option was the People's Palace, because it's a place whereby the history of the city is held. And a lot of people who are Gorbals born and bred are saying it should be in the Gorbals.
I just wonder
where would you stand on that?
Well, I would say undoubtedly the Gorbals. You know, I've spoken to a few people to this, and you know, because some of us have, you know, seen the campaign and all that stuff to support it. I think it's got to be the Gorbals, because that's where he was born. And
is there anywhere in particular that you're thinking?
I think Florence. Always, my mum used to say she saw Benny in these latter days, because, you know, he was
a bad way, wasn't he?
He's a really, really bad way, and she saw him not long before he died. I think, you know, hanging about close, and it's terrible to see somebody like, you know, world famous, flyweight champion, in that condition. And I think he might have lived in Florence Street at one stage, and of course the thing is, a lot of these streets are no longer there, but I think it should be a statue to Benny Lynch. He'd be in the heart of the Gobbles and nowhere else. I would be pretty sure about that, and I think most people would be, because you know, he's one of Gobbles' famous sons, you know.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I can see the point of the Central Station one, honestly, because of the volume of people that are coming in, and he's a famous class region. But you know, for a guy who is synonymous with the Gorbals, then you do think that there must be somewhere in the Gorbals that you could put this in a prominent position. That people would get to see it. So moving on, just the area is, you know, regeneration's a big word these days. So what's your thoughts when you see the Gorbals these days, as opposed to the Gorbals that you grew up in the 50s and 60s?
I mean, I mean, in some ways, I mean, you have, you know, people naturally say the old days were the best because you could leave it, you classy, you could leave your door open and all that stuff. But really, the conditions were poor. I think it's but went through a period where there's still whole tracts of it, you know, or wilderness. But it looks to me as if it's kind of been regenerated again, which is good to see. I mean, they went through this phase. Remember when they knocked the old stuff down? They built like Queen Elizabeth Square. And you know these things. I knew a couple of people that stayed in there. Was in there a few times. I mean, the place was, you know, the walls were running with damp and all the rest of it. Just as an aside, the day they knocked him down, September 1993, a woman got killed. Helen, my dad was standing beside her. He ended up in hospital.
Really?
And he got struck by a woman. I mean, you know, you know. So thoughts, hopefully don't build things like that any longer. But no, I think it's regenerating, but still there's a bit more to do. But you know, there's a lot of houses getting built opposite the citizens and the cobblestones and all that stuff, and they look as if they're a lot better quality than the stuff that was built
before. It's a wee bit like oven when I was growing up, because I don't object to them knocking houses down, because obviously they weren't fit for living in. But the problem is that we grew up in the Glasgow, or certainly I grew up in the Glasgow, you're a wee bit older. It was just big swathes of derelict land.
Yeah.
Depressing, you know what I mean? There was nothing getting built.
No, not
nothing
at all.
Getting built for years.
No, I know. And some of the houses they knocked down, you think perhaps they could have saved them. I mean, they done that in the Oaklands, they saved some of them opposite Old Richmond Park. But unfortunately, they spent a lot of money, you know, refurbishing them, but they ended up having to knock them down. And you know, you don't realise how big an area it is, actually.
Right.
You know?
It's massive.
And, you know, it's looking promising, I would say that, and certainly, you know, the conditions of the past should remain there. There's no doubt about that. You know, they were horrific, to be quite honest. People, you know, 15, 16 people in a single room and all that stuff, you know.
There's interesting photos that you see right up to the mid-1970s. Yeah. You know, like you've got these professional photographers who went into the area.
Yeah.
And you know, when you see it, you actually think, well, geez, well, that's the 50s, and then he says, no, this is 1974, and you're thinking, I remember that. But I mean, like, that's appalling.
I know. I mean, you know, when you tell people now, you know, younger people now, like, you know, you didn't have an inside toilet, no water, you know, no central heating,
no double glazing.
Double glazing, you know, cold bunker in the kitchen or in the lobby, you know, all that stuff, you know, romantic as it is to look back. It was character building, as they say, but
times have moved on.
I think we're a wee bit better than that now, you know.
Right, I can't speak to you but without finishing with the subject of European away trips. Now I'm fascinated, I'll tell you why, because anybody listening to this these days probably has been to some European trip. You might have been to the local ones in England or Ireland, or it's nothing these days to jump in a chartered flight or get some of the EasyJets and the Ryanairs and go to some far-flung foreign place to see Celtic, because it is relatively easy now to certainly travel compared to when we were boys. It is so commonplace these days. Now, what was your first European away game then? Would have been Lisbon?
No. Well, I mean, you say Lisbon. I mean, European, out with the shores of Britain.
Yeah, out with Britain.
It was certainly Lisbon, I mean, it was at Liverpool, it was at Leeds, but it was at Lisbon. And then I went to Amsterdam. I went to Amsterdam.
71?
Yeah. I went to Milan in semi-final European Cup.
72?
Yeah. I was due to go to Atletico Madrid in 74. And I got a phone call, you know, on late on the Friday to say, Celtic are not happy about any of the supporters going. And of course, this was pre-internet. I was going on my own. This was pre-internet days. So, you send your cheque back and that's it. So I'm blooming, you know, in a fizz because I couldn't go. So I couldn't go to that. In 75, I went to Iceland. I went to Borussia Porto. And I went to East Germany in the 76.
Now that's really interesting, because there couldn't have been a lot of Celtic fans going to these places.
No, there wasn't. I mean, the story really then was in 75, what happened is there's a well known blogger, Brogan.
Aye, Jim.
Well, his dad owned Enterprises.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he'd done all the Lisbon stuff and all that. And I went to Iceland with all the Enterprises. In fact, Big Shuggy Edelson, he stayed a day more than the rest of the team that came back, and he got us into a few discos and all that stuff as well. So it was quite interesting being there.
Ireland's a beer place.
it was ridiculously expensive.
So it was
really, really. Well, I mean, it's still dear now.
But it was dearer then.
It was really ridiculous. And you know, it was like, yeah, somebody's like £1 for a plate of chips, because we stayed at the Lothlidear Hotel, which was right at the airport, you know. And I went with Holiday Enterprises to that game. Boa Vista Porto was the next game. Mm-hmm. And before the game, I'd booked up to go with Holiday Enterprises, but we got the word back saying, look, it's not happening. But if you can get someone to sponsor you going to team flight, you can go on it.
What do you mean by sponsor?
Well, somebody to talk for you.
I'll speak up for you.
I speak up for you. Unfortunately, one thing I didn't mention earlier about Sarsfield, I don't think I did, was with a strong connection with Sean Fallon. So
who was caretaker manager, course, ironically.
Exactly. So I said, look, I'm sure Sean would vouch for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a 20-year-old guy or something like that. They knew who we were, the family knew Sarsfield. So lo and behold, I got on the plane to Boa Vista. And I think there was only about 20 there. No females allowed on the team plane, of course, in those days.
Why? No, why would that be?
Just
the rules.
That's the rules. Then get back to the Sarsfield Constitution. Actually, it said there no ladies allowed on the bus.
Oh dear.
So
dear,
that's
dear.
Obviously that's now changed. But you know, no ladies got on the team flight. So Boa Vista, yeah, and of course that was just at the time when there was a kind of revolution going on in Portugal. So it was quite interesting times in Porto. I remember the army were there in big style.
There's a famous story Peter Lanchford tells about how he's taking the bye kick.
Yeah.
And know that way that it was nothing each at a time. He says, I'm trying to waste a bit of time. Yeah. So he says, I've put the board down and I've walked off the park to take a big run to take the bye kick.
Yeah.
And I felt the tap on the shoulder and it was a guy with a machine gun. Yeah. Tell him in no uncertain terms, you hurry up and get to take that kick.
Because the army were stationed
all over. He nearly wet himself and he saw the guy with a big gun.
He still managed to save a penalty.
He did, he saved the jerseys that night.
So that was kind of the start of getting on the team flights. Uh-huh. So I went to Porto, and then East Germany was the next one, and again there was probably even fewer there, although recently I know there's been a bit of exchange of tweets. But some guys did go. I don't remember meeting them, but some guys did go in a minibus.
I've seen that one. I think it left for the salt market,
Denison or something, or whatever. But again, we were on the team flight for that.
Mm-hmm.
That was an experience.
Would that have been an overnight stay in any days then, or did you just come right back after?
No. It was like you were there for 2 nights.
Right, so you were there a night before the game and a night after the night of the game.
No, we travelled back. That time we travelled back right after the game. I remember that in East Germany. But we were there 2 nights. We were there 2 nights and we came back the night of the game.
We have to make the point here again, because people might be listening, and younger guys.
Yeah.
East Germany was communist rule in the days. We still had the Berlin Wall. Yeah. You still had the communist bloc.
Yes.
So in order to get into East Germany in the first place, you just couldn't. It's not like now where you can travel freely.
No, not at all. No. And you needed visas. And that was a famous trip where Celtic had to adopt
Roy
because he wasn't 18. He was on the team. And God, I mean, it was getting to the stage where we thought Andy Young enough was going to actually get into the team as well, the supporters, because everybody was injured, you know, and that was just a disaster, because we get women.
But we should actually beat them over the two legs.
Absolutely.
We gave them a doing at Park, and missed a penalty.
Yep.
And then they scored in the last minute, ironically, but only shot they had.
And then they scored with Oleg Blank, I think, both of them.
Yeah,
scored 5 minutes into the game, and there were all sorts of stuff happened.
And the irony is, I'm sure this is true, that if they get through at the semis, would they get West Ham?
West Ham, that's correct, yeah.
So it was who got to the final that year.
I know.
And I think we were a better team than West Ham.
It was just classic. But, I mean, these were experiences, going to, you know, East Germany, and then it was Poland, Wisla Krakow again, very, very few Celtic supporters there. Again, behind Iron Curtain, you know, so these were great trips to go in, because it was a whole new world, you know.
Was that the last one then, Krakow?
Krakow was 76.
But was that your last trip? On the plane?
On the plane? No. No. We went to I travelled on the team. I think the last trip on the team plane was the Real Madrid quarter final.
1980.
And a wee funny story that James Sanderson, who
you know who James Sanderson is,
a lot of other people, but he was a wee guy in Radio Clyde, you know, how long does
a great character,
a great character. He told me a really funny story, because it was apt, because we were going to Madrid, because I was sitting near him in the plane, and he was saying Rangers played Real Madrid in the European Cup, of course, a few years before, and they beat 1-0 at Ibrox, and they went to play them in the Bernabeu. Very young team, really good Rangers team, Willie Henderson, you know, Davy Wilson, all these guys, Ian McMillan. And he said, the referee comes in for the game, and he's saying, right, out you go, Rangers. So they go out onto the pitch, you know, and they're kicking the ball about, and they're going, where's Real Madrid? I wonder what's happened here. And he said, the lights in the stadium went out. And what's happened here? And he said, next minute, this big beam of light came on, it shone into the tunnel, and Real Madrid just kind of walked out with a white strip. And he said,
"What, glowing?"
Jimmy, Willie Henderson turned to Ronnie McKinnon and said, "Hey, big man, you're going to fuck tonight." And they did.
My dad told me an interesting story about the first leg. The first leg was at Ibrox.
Yeah,
and Puskas scored the winner a few minutes to go,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And the Real Madrid manager, who I don't know his name, went mental at the touchline. Yeah. And apparently, the translation in the paper the next day was, he says, he says I was raging, he scored that goal, he's taken 20,000 after the second leg in Madrid. Aye. Because they, you know, nothing eats a close game.
Yeah, of course.
I want nothing, yeah, win, then it's done.
Yeah.
So out of all the trips you went on, then what was your favourite, apart from Lisbon obviously being a case in point? Is there one that sticks out?
Is that
a personal favourite?
I have to say the first time we went to Kazakhstan was, because it was even by the standards of going to Eastern Europe in the 70s and stuff, to get to the first game, because you really had to jump through hoops to get the visa and the trip organised. And bottom line, you're playing in Asia, you know.
That's right.
And the response to the locals,
it's about as far away as you can get.
I think it was only 10 supporters made it or something like that. Probably stands out just something because of the.
Was that Carrigandy?
That was Carrigandy. Beat 2-0.
That's right, Dundee United strips.
Aye, big long show ins. At least they can take shies, which is another contentious issue. But they can take shies at the end of the box. But no, I would say possibly there. But of course, they've been there a few times now. It's like, going to, you know,
Well, you're some man for the travelling.
Yeah, well, I think you get the bug. You know, I think. Being in Lisbon and, you know, travelling abroad to watch a team playing is, I don't know, I like travelling anyway.
It's special.
And you know,
it's a cultural thing as well, because it's not just the football you're getting to see.
That's the way I look at it,
a different environment and a different culture.
That's the way I look at it. I've been in lots of places I've never been in,
which is the whole idea for European competition in the first place.
Exactly.
To exchange cultures and friendship and, you know, that kind of,
it's kind of lost its wee bit recently because of all the, you know, the stuff, you know, and the way you get treated at some of the away games and all that stuff. But I've just been lucky, you know, health and wealth and patience of family and employers and all that, I've been able to get all the games, you know. And of course, in those days, you would maybe get one a year, you know.
Yeah,
and then you get knocked out. As
you're
lucky to see a goal. Now it's like, you know, you've been in Trondheim next week, it's like going to Aberdeen, you know. It's getting a bit, you know.
Well, similar. I think in that subject that we'll part there, because it's been a fascinating hour or so talking to you about the trip down memory lane in terms of the old Gorbals, the supporters and all the rest of the stuff. And then, you know, I'm sure when you were a boy you never thought you would see half the places that you visited.
No, not at all, no.
So thanks very much, Gordon, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much, Stephen, thank you.
Bring me sunshine in your smile.
We've had some excellent results and some excellent performances recently, and by the time you're listening to this podcast, either we will be just about to play the League Cup semi-final, League Cup final against Aberdeen, or we will hopefully have won our seventh trophy in a row under Brendan Rodgers. Whatever it is, I hope you've enjoyed the podcast with St Anthony and Gordon talking about the Gorbals, and I know I say this all the time, but yes, we will have more podcasts on soon. Anyway, enough of me. The Celtic FC Foundation bucket collection is coming up against Kilmarnock next week. So, I'll say, that's St Anthony with Gordon Cowan, and this is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless. Good night.
In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.